We'll just go down. House Judiciary come to order. Today is Thursday, February 9th, 2017. We have an open with an informational meeting overview of the Oregon Office of Public Defender Services. Nancy Cosine. Name if you want to be up there too.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker. Vice Chair Olson is not with us yet, but members of the committee. My name is Nancy Cosine. I'm the Executive Director at the Office of Public Defense Services, and we are very happy to be here with you today. Thank you for making time for us. With me at the table is Amy Miller. She is our Deputy General Counsel and Attorney Manager for our Parent-Child Representation Program. As we get into the slides, Amy will take over and navigate you through that portion of the presentation. So, today, we will cover our agency structure and responsibilities, a little bit about our challenges, and some of the solutions in the PCRP program, and then give you a little bit of insight, if it's not already clear, when and why you might want to contact our office during the session. So this is an overview of where we fit in state government. We are within the judicial branch of government. We were created in 2001 as a separate independent state agency. Initially, the Public Defense Services Commission took over just the state public defender office doing appellate work. And in 2003, the Indigent Defense Services Division of the Judicial Department split off and joined. And since 2003, the office has existed with those two components. The obligations of the Public Defense Services Commission are actually set forth in statute. In summary, they must maintain a public defender system that is cost-efficient and that meets state and national standards. You can find a lot more about the commission and their responsibilities in ORS Chapter 151. Our commission members are appointed by the Chief Justice, who serves as a non-voting ex officio member of the commission. The commission members are listed there, and what I would tell you about these commission members is they are incredibly dedicated public servants. They actually volunteer their time. We meet approximately 9 times per year for at least 4 hours, and we meet in different locations around the state so that we hear from different constituent groups. The office itself is structured with essentially two parts. We have our appellate division with 44 lawyers. We provide representation to parents in dependency proceedings and also in criminal cases. Then we also have our financial services, which provides all of the budgeting for our agency, and they work in concert with the contract services unit to provide trial-level services all across the state. We have over 100 contracts statewide. So, in order to be eligible for our services, a client has to have, it's sort of a two-pronged analysis. The proceeding itself has to be a proceeding where there's a right to counsel, and then the person has to be financially qualified. The initial determinant is whether or not the person is within federal food stamp guidelines, which is about 130% of the poverty level. So, by definition, our clients are struggling with issues of poverty. The case types that we cover are listed here, and I think those are all things that you would expect to have covered by statute or constitutional right to counsel provisions. There are case types that are less clear, and so I'll spell those out on the next slide. If it's a municipal court proceeding, there is a right to counsel in some of those cases. It's just not the state's burden to pay for that. It's actually the municipality. So sometimes we get calls on those cases, and we will refer people back to the municipality. Violations, administrative, civil cases, relief from sex offender registration in all but a few circumstances, restraining order, probate guardianships, and divorce proceedings are all case types where people often would like to have a right to counsel, but there is not such a right. And what I mean is a state-paid right to counsel. A little bit about our appellate division. We are the institutional counterpart to the Department of Justice. As I said, we have 44 lawyers. Those lawyers have large caseloads, and they appear in front of the Oregon Court of Appeals, the Oregon Supreme Court, and occasionally the U.S. Supreme Court. And they work very efficiently and diligently and have a very hold themselves to a very high standard of excellence. Our contract services, as I mentioned, span the state. We have two-year contracts, and these contracts are created with different types of providers. So we have some nonprofit public defender offices. We also have consortium groups. These are attorneys who have banded together for the purpose of providing public defense services. And then we also have law firms. And in situations where there's a conflict of interest with one of our contract providers or a shortage of providers, we use an hourly rate model. So in terms of caseload and who's covering that caseload, we've got about 54% of the caseload being covered by consortia members, about 34% by public defenders, 1% by private bar, and 4% by law firms. 11% by law firms. I need new glasses. Public defense caseload by case type. This just gives you a sense of what types of cases we're working on. Large percentage there, 30% of felony cases, 32% of misdemeanors, 31% are juvenile. Delinquencies are about 4%, and then we have all other case types at only about 3%. We also have death penalty contracts. We have 29 attorneys under contract and 20 mitigators, 69 cases currently pending. We receive approximately 9 new cases every year. The reason that the pending cases are so much higher than the cases filed is that they tend to stick around for a while. So they'll make their way through the system, get bounced back to trial court, and start again. So challenges. Our primary challenges are attracting and retaining lawyers. This is a high-volume practice with a very low rate of pay. Our case rates tend to be very low, which is what drives up the caseload for our providers. And I know we have several people in this group who understand what I'm talking about and kind of have seen it firsthand. So we also hear that high student debt load is preventing people from staying with the practice. Different literature suggests that students coming out with $250,000 in student debt load is not uncommon. We've had lawyers tell us that. When you combine the high caseload with that high student debt load, and in consortia where it's not a nonprofit or a government entity, they're not eligible for loan repayment programs, so like public interest loan repayment programs, and so what happens is that they have a heavier debt burden compared to their income. So we hear that oftentimes people just can't stick with the practice. Additionally, the cases are becoming more and more complex. That is because, several reasons, but you know, I like to do the visual. This is the criminal code from 1986, and this is the criminal code from 2016. Things have changed. Not only do we have a lot more in terms of laws, we have a very well-developed body of case law. How these laws are interpreted and how they relate to each other takes a lot of, as you all know, a lot of research. So increasing complexity. And then we also, of course, have the development of neuroscience. We know so much more now about people and what's at the root of problems. Lawyers are ethically obligated to look into not only the circumstances of the case, but really the circumstances of their clients. So these cases are becoming increasingly complex. What we hear from other stakeholders is that lawyers have too many cases. We hear this pretty consistently, and we try hard to put in place mechanisms to prevent that from happening. But with low case rates, it's a recurring problem. Other states have actually developed standards that are particular to their state. We've been looking at what other states are doing. This is just an example in Missouri and Texas, where they recently studied caseload and what's an appropriate workload for an attorney. They've developed numbers like 178 to 216 for a misdemeanor caseload. And what we hear here in Oregon is that newer attorneys are pretty routinely assigned 400 misdemeanor cases per year or more. So this is an area where we are continuing to focus and try to develop solutions. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Amy, who's going to talk a little bit about the work we're doing in dependency cases and trying to address some of these problems in a really concrete way.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you so much for your time today. It's a delight to be here to talk with you about the program I manage, the Parent-Child Representation Program. This program was launched in August 2014, initially in Lynn and Yamhill counties, and it was really a response to over a decade's worth of documentation about deficiencies in the quality of representation that parents and children receive in juvenile court cases. As a result of some positive impacts in those two counties, we were able to self-fund an expansion to Columbia County about a year ago. The goals of the program, first, to provide competent and effective legal representation throughout the case. Second, to make that representation meaningful, so there's a client-centered approach to legal representation. And third, to improve outcomes, to track and measure and see if we're actually making a difference
for children
and families.
Amy, excuse me, you need to say your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I not? So sorry. Amy Miller, Deputy General Counsel, Office of Public Defense Services.
Thank you.
Sorry, Chair. So, this slide contains some of the key parts of the program, but really it's a significant change in the way OPDS contracts for legal services. Attorneys in this program adhere to a workload contract for services with specific obligations that really lay the foundation for, you know, enhanced legal representation. You know, one example is that attorneys have contract requirements around how they're expected to spend their time, generally one-third of their time with clients, one-third in court and at case-related meetings, and then one-third of time preparing for court and doing case preparation and analysis. The program also imposes a caseload limit, which allows attorneys the time to provide quality legal representation. You heard Nancy talk about high caseloads. Practically speaking, they're problematic in many ways. They prevent attorneys from spending time with parents and children. They prevent attorneys from attending work outside of the courtroom. So when lawyers have high caseloads, they're always in court, and they're not able to be an out-of-court lawyer. And in these cases, in these dependency cases, which can go on for years in the life of a child and family, much of the actual work and advocacy is done outside of the courtroom. And when caseloads are excessively high, what happens is cases are actually delayed because attorneys aren't available and to schedule things on the court's docket, and it actually causes delays in these cases. So attorneys in this program also have access to case managers. These are social service professionals who serve as part of the legal team. And they work really on the most complex of cases. They're only available in about 10% of cases. But the strength of this multidisciplinary approach to legal representation is that they provide confidential assistance to individual clients to help them overcome barriers that led to court involvement. So unlike the Department of Human Services, which also has caseworkers involved in these case managers focus only on that one individual at a time and, you know, are able to, again, engage in some confidential problem-solving and motivational interviewing to move the case forward. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the tangible benefits of competent legal representation for parents, children, and youth. First of all, enhanced procedural justice. You know, even when it's absolutely necessary, state involvement in the life of a family is really traumatic. It can be difficult for parents and children to trust agency caseworkers, and this lack of trust can lead to barriers in engagement that can be really difficult and sometimes, frankly, impossible to overcome. The concept. And what happens then is that parents and children feel like the system is unfair, like they haven't been able to be heard, like they don't have any control over what's happening to them. So the concept of procedural justice is simple, that when a party experiences fairness, they are more likely to comply with court orders, they're more likely to trust the system, they're more likely to engage in consultation with their attorney and engage in their case. With procedural justice comes increased engagement and a willingness to work to ameliorate the conditions and circumstances that led to court involvement in the first place. But procedural justice is broader than just that. It includes fundamental fairness and due process. And, you know, attorneys who represent parents and children must protect the constitutional and statutory rights of their clients. And in juvenile cases, the vast majority of them result in jurisdiction and settlement, but there are times when litigation is necessary to prevent unwarranted state intervention in families. I have a little bit more to talk about. So legal representation also helps ensure more thoughtful and effective case planning while holding the agency accountable for adhering to its policies, procedures, and legal obligations. Attorneys can contest removals. They identify relatives who can serve as care providers or placements. They advocate for safety plans and resources attorneys and parents, attorneys for parents and children, you know, can be actively involved when they have the time to be able to do this. And, you know, so often in these cases, you know, there's sort of this one size fits all approach to addressing the needs that are out there. And our clients, as you heard Nancy talk about, present with a complex array of needs, and it's really essential that someone be able to problem solve those needs and identify individualized solutions when it's, you know, when it's needed. So strong legal advocacy is associated with expedited permanency, and there's a growing body of research that points to this fact that competent and effective representation is really associated with a reduction in the use of foster care beds. In Washington State, and a program similar to ours, that program saves about $7.5 million a year in foster care costs, and that's after covering the cost of the program itself. Another study on the effectiveness of child representation points to the fact that children who receive competent and effective legal representation are 40% more likely to go home within a six-month period than those who don't. I wanted to talk a little bit about the things that we've observed in our program over the past year. Since the program started in 2014, we've been tracking these same metrics. And although this slide just contains the past year's worth of data, the changes have really been consistent since the program began. I do want to point out that I'm a lawyer. I'm not a statistician. And these are observations rooted mostly in DHS data. But, you know, this is not a full evaluation and does not represent necessarily causation or association. But what we've seen in these counties is a consistent reduction in the use of foster care since the PCRP began, and it's been a double-digit reduction, about an average of 15%, which is sizable, particularly because across the state the number has slightly ticking up over time. Counties served by this program have a higher rate of reunification, and children are spending less time waiting to reunify in this program. Children in the PCRP counties also spend less time waiting for permanency of other types. And really the foundation here, I believe, is improved legal representation. So in summary, the first 2 years of our program have been encouraging. The data is encouraging, but this isn't rocket science. These results are consistent with what has been observed in the state of Washington over the past 16 years. They're consistent with other programs similar to this that have cropped up around the country. You may know that over the interim, the governor's office staffed a task force that was charged with looking at legal representation for both parents and children and also the agency in these types of cases. And that task force worked for a year and really took a deep dive into this system. And after considering cost effectiveness and positive outcomes, recommended an expansion of this model of programs statewide for the reasons that I'm talking about today. And I'm going to turn it back over to Nancy.
So, hopefully we have given you in a very short amount of time enough information so that you have a sense of when you might want to contact our office. We do want to be available to you as a resource when you are considering new laws and you have questions about how that might impact the public defense budget or, you know, what the current caseload looks like. Please feel free to give us a call. You might want to know more about what public defense looks like in your county or another county, or perhaps just have a sense of the impact of proposed legislation from more of a system standpoint. So anytime you have a question, please feel free to reach out, contact us. Amy Miller is focusing on the juvenile bills. I'm looking at a little bit of everything. We also have Paul Levy in our office. He's general counsel, and he's looking at bills that have sort of an agency impact. And then for this session, we have Eric Dietrich working with us on criminal law bills. So we're hoping that with this staffing, we can be a resource to you when you need us. So I'm happy to answer questions if you have any, and want to thank you again for your time.
Representative Lyle.
I think it's the third slide in on yours, Nancy, mm-hmm. had the financial eligibility criteria.
Mm-hmm.
The third bullet point talks about if the applicant's income exceeds food stamp guidelines, then I guess I'm reading into it, the court kind of does a less formal assessment. How does that actually work?
So the court, Chair Barker and Representative Vile, in my experience, the court does an inquiry. And the court, in advance of the proceeding, has typically collected financial information through their verification office. And so that person usually has provided to the court information, and the judge has that information available to them. And so through that inquiry process, they'll determine whether or not there is a hardship created that warrants the appointment of counsel.
And is, other than the food stamp guideline, is there any specific threshold that your office gives to judges or that's standard among the bench that would help them know, okay, yeah, this one fits or this one doesn't?
Chair Barker, Representative Vile, the court really runs the application contribution program and the verification program. Our office does produce standards, but there isn't something specific on that particular piece that would give me any more information to provide.
And do you have a sense that there's abuse where someone maybe does have means that gets a free lawyer, or is it the other way around? What's your sense?
Chair Barker, Representative Vile, I think we hear more frequently that private attorneys charge so much that we have a gap. So there are people who may not hit the federal food stamp guideline mark, but don't have enough to retain a lawyer and won't necessarily be assessed as having a right to counsel. So that's what I hear more about. But there are processes in place to challenge the appointment of counsel. And so if someone feels that there has been a wrongful appointment, that can be challenged through a court process. And those hearings do happen. So verification offices have the ability to actually run credit checks and other things to look into the veracity of what's been provided to the court.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Just as a side note of that, several years ago in Multnomah County Court, they were checking. They had somebody that was just checking those, not the people actually involved. And I was sure they would find nothing but fraud, and it was just the opposite. Most of those people really were truly qualified for the public defender.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Greenleck, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nancy, I have two sets of issues I just want to comment on a little bit. The first is that caseload question. Mm-hmm. I think you started your discussion by saying we wanted to be within standards, and I think we're not within standards right now. I hope we're moving things to do something about that. The other is the disparity of pay between the defense attorneys and the prosecuting attorneys. Over the last few years, it seems to me, has gotten worse. Mm-hmm. Is there anything online to do something about that?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenleck, yes, there is. We have a policy option package in our budget that would address the pay parity concerns that you've raised. And sorry, your question was two-part. One was, what about the caseloads? And two is, what about the pay parity? We have been tracking what the disparity is. And in counties like your county, you know, at the top of the scale, non-management prosecutors and non-management public defenders, there is a significant disparity, about 50%, 40 to 50%, depending on which jurisdiction you're looking at. And so we're aware of that. And the policy option package that we've developed looked statewide at what we think it would cost to close that gap in every county, and it's about $34 million. So it's not an insignificant number, and it's really a funding issue. And caseloads.
Well, you could reduce the pay of prosecutors, but that might not serve the
thing. I think
judges.
You don't have the power to do that.
No, I don't want to reduce the pay of judges.
$50,000 a year.
The other piece of that, the caseload piece, is really tied into the caseload rate, the case rate. So in a misdemeanor case, if the rate is around 400, and we have regionalized rates, so it depends on what region you're in, what the rate is. But you have to take a fair number. What I understand is that contractors have to take a fair number before they can cover their overhead and other costs of business, you know, just to make the dynamic work. And so I think that the caseload and the pay parity are both factors that are a result of lower case rates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just one other question. My sense is that, well, it's not a sense, it's personal experience. our law firm, which is a civil law firm, been around for about 30 years, has always wanted to be more involved in providing pro bono defense work, mostly as a way to get experience for young lawyers that have never been in trial or whatever. And we found that it was tough to coordinate with either the county folks that were handing out the lawyers. And I'm wondering if anybody's ever looked at something that would be of a way to help counties facilitate those private firms that were interested in sending their young lawyers in for some experience to help relieve some of that caseload that Representative Greenlick's talking about.
Chair Barker, Representative Bile, I would be more than happy to come talk with you about what those mechanisms could look like. And certainly, the way that we operate, we issue a request for proposals. And so the majority of our services are provided through contract because that, for us, provides a predictable payment structure so that we know we can accurately budget. We also have hourly providers, and the mechanism for getting a contract or becoming an hourly provider is a little different, and I would be more than happy to.
Some of these free lawyers might be pretty good. Maybe this is my freshman thing, Mr. Chair. I can look at helping to do that.
I can comment on that. Representative Vial, I actually did that when I was in private practice. And part of the challenge is you're talking about consortium or nonprofit that are not controlled by public defense services. So it's whether or not that essentially private law firm wants to take on the additional lawyer. And so we had a deal with the Metropolitan Public Defenders, but from their perspective, they had to have inexperienced civil lawyers following them around, and their caseloads are so high that part of it is it's a burden to have an inexperienced civil lawyer following you around, frankly. But it was a fantastic experience. But that was something that the two law firms worked out together. Because they're independent contractors.
And we've tried a couple of times to do that, but never did find the right way to. But I'm convinced that there are some of those young lawyers are pretty smart lawyers, and maybe they did need more training, but they could have done as well as some of the public defenders that I watched from time to time.
Oh, yeah, no, it was a great experience, I think. I think you're absolutely right. I think the issue is whether or not you can find the right fit between the law firms.
Well, if we thought out of the box about a way that maybe a coordinating counsel could help to facilitate that, it might actually save money in the long run. So that's my thought.
Okay. Any further questions? I just would comment, thank you very much for the service and the service your underpaid members do, understaffed members do. I don't know if there's any place in the country where they're really up to speed. Most people, at least I have the impression that justice in the South the United States is less than other places. I would recommend anybody Gideon's Angels. You'll probably find it on Netflix. It shows the public defenders. I can't remember what state that is, Alabama or Georgia. And I just recently have been reading. I kind of follow New Orleans crime news a little bit, and the public defender down there told the courts that we can no longer defend serious crimes because you don't provide us any money. We just can't do it. And down there in one parish, a judge just assigns lawyers.
Oh, yeah.
And he had a serious crime that somebody's looking life without, and he appointed a tax attorney, and the tax attorney said, I had 1 hour or 1.5 hours of criminal law when I was in law school. I don't know anything about this. And the judge said, it's your case. And you can only imagine. I mean, I don't know if the accused is guilty or not, but he's guilty. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So anyway, okay. Again, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank
you. Close the information meeting on the Office of Public Defense and open an overview of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Tim Callahan and Patty Perlow, please. While there's disparity in pay, I don't think people are overpaid either.
Thank you, Chair Barker.
I take back my proposal.
Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Williamson and Olson, thank you very much for having us here this afternoon. I do want to take just a moment, because if I don't say it now, I will forget, and address Representative Vile's question about getting trial practice for civil attorneys. I know when I started in Multnomah County, which was many years ago, 1985, they had, and I think they continue to have, a program there to provide trial service for civil attorneys to come in. We used to call them rent-a-DA. But it was very successful.
Before I forget, you have to put your name on the record.
I'm sorry. Tim Colahan, Executive Director for the DA's Association. I believe the program still continues. You might contact Rod Underhill about it. But I will warn you that I know of at least two very good civil attorneys who quit the civil practice and began working as prosecutors, and one ended up in the U.S. Attorney's Office. So it's worked out well for us. Thank you very much. Just a little bit about myself. Joining me this afternoon is Lane County District Attorney Patty Perlow. What I want to do is talk to you a little bit about DAs, the Office of the District Attorney, a little bit about roles and responsibility of the District Attorneys, and then end with a short blurb about the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And Patty's going to talk a little bit about practice and management in Lane County, a larger office. I came to the Oregon District Attorneys Association in September as their executive director. Prior to that, I was district attorney in Harney County for 30 years. The Office of District Attorney is actually a constitutional office. It's similar in that way to the governor and the secretary of state, as well as the treasurer's office. And our constitutional authority is in Article 7, Section 17. District attorneys are designated as the law officer of each county of the state. The mission of district attorneys is to uphold the United States Constitution, the Constitution and laws of the state of Oregon, to preserve the safety of the public, to protect the rights of crime victims, and to pursue justice for all citizens with skill, honor, and integrity. As far as the district attorneys in the state of Oregon, there are 36 independently elected district attorneys, one in each county. The Office of District Attorney varies greatly when you go across Oregon. You go from offices that have the elected DA and perhaps one part-time employee to counties such as Washington County, Multnomah County, which literally have hundreds of employees and many, many deputy DAs. District Attorney is a nonpartisan office. And the term of office is 4 years, so DAs run every 4 years. Although the elected DA is a state officer, the responsibility really for the funding of the DA's office falls almost entirely on counties, because they pay the salaries of the deputy DAs and for most all of the district attorney employees in that office. And finally, district attorneys throughout Oregon are considered a part of county leadership and are actively involved in working with county commissions and county courts across Oregon. Core functions of Oregon's district attorney include the prosecution of all felony cases. They also prosecute the majority of misdemeanor cases in Oregon. There are some areas of Oregon that have prosecution function that occurs in municipal courts. DAs don't handle those matters. DAs also handle juvenile dependency and delinquency matters. DAs provide child support enforcement for cases where there is non-public assistance, no state debt in those cases. We provide crime victim assistance and also handle public records review. I know some of you have not been involved in the criminal justice system. Some of you have. So just briefly, I want to talk to you a little bit about what is the job of the DA actually entail. cases actually begin by police reports coming to a district attorney's office. And those can come from municipal police departments. Those can come from county, state, in some areas, even from tribal police departments. And they come in the form of police reports involving people that may be in custody. Some may have been cited to appear. Some there has been no action taken yet. And those police reports are reviewed by the district attorney or a deputy district attorney to determine if evidence of a crime exists. If it's a misdemeanor charge, the district attorney makes the charging decision and files a complaint or information, and the case proceeds from that point. In the case of a felony, many times district attorneys, if a person is in custody, will file what's called an information of felony. However, that particular document, the charge has to be reviewed by a grand jury or through a preliminary hearing in order for it to proceed further. And, of course, the state will present that place. In Oregon, most DAs use a grand jury process. You'll probably remember a little bit of history of the grand jury going back many, many years. It's a limit on the power of the state, on the king, actually, to make sure that evidence is sufficient to proceed when a felony charge is being brought. If a grand jury reviews that information and returns an indictment, the suspect is arraigned at that time and makes his first appearance, his or her first appearance. Either court-appointed counsel or retained counsel is provided for. In Oregon, most courts after arraignment provide about 30 to 45 days for the parties to engage in plea discussions. If there is no plea that is worked out, then the case obviously goes to trial. In Oregon, well over 90% of all criminal cases are resolved by plea. Less than 10% of all criminal cases proceed to an actual trial in Oregon. And cases can be resolved in many, many ways. Many courts or many counties in the state have specialty court programs where people can be referred into veterans courts, drug courts, mental health courts. There are deferred adjudication programs for drug offenders. And district attorneys work very hard with public defenders and also their community corrections programs to come up with sanctions and programs that are going to work for people that are sentenced and plead guilty. Most defendants, when the cases go to trial, are represented by court-appointed counsel. Obviously, the district attorney represents the state in the prosecution of those cases. Trials can be either to a judge or a jury. The defendant makes the choice of that. And at trial, obviously, the decision is made of whether there is guilt or innocence. Cases involving a guilty verdict, typically the case is reset at that point for a sentencing hearing. Any appeal is not handled by district attorneys. Those matters are handled by the Attorney General's Office and the Department of Justice. Just a couple slides about Oregon sentencing practices. When we're looking at felony convictions in the state of Oregon, only about 24% of felony cases end up with an individual being sentenced to the Department of Corrections for a prison sentence. That leaves about little over 75% of the rest of those cases are either handled by local control where they serve a sentence of less than a year in the county jail, or they're placed on probation. District attorneys, I think across the state, deem their highest priority to be handling cases involving violent crimes and person-to-person crimes. And Oregon leads the nation in the percentage of offenders who are incarcerated that are there for commission of violent crimes. Almost 70% of people that are in our prisons in Oregon right now are there because of the commission of a violent crime. A corollary obviously, Oregon is among one of the states with the lowest percentage of drug offenders who are serving time in a state facility, and it's somewhere around 7 to 8%. And just to clarify, these are almost entirely people that have been convicted of delivery charges, manufacture charges. There are very few people in custody in prison for possession.
I have a question. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. So on these two slides, do we have a gender breakdown?
I don't have that, but Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, we can certainly get that information for you.
I'd be very interested in that.
We did recently get some information from the Criminal Justice Commission, which did give us a breakdown of all females that are in custody.
Great. Kevin Neely says he has that.
We can do that.
So.
The Oregon District Attorneys Association is a private nonprofit association. It's funded almost entirely by members' dues. Our association provides centralized training for deputy district attorneys, for child abuse case workers, child support specialists, victims advocates, and others involved in the criminal justice area. We provide advocacy on criminal justice issues. We coordinate with law enforcement and partners at both the state and local level. We identify and pursue grant opportunities related to criminal justice. Currently, ODA has three different grants. We receive a grant from the Oregon Department of Transportation to provide training related to DUII prosecutions. We also get another grant that provides funding for training of domestic violence issues. And then most recently, we received a $200,000 grant from the Criminal Justice Commission to begin a witness intimidation support program, which we are very close to having on board and ready to go with, to provide funding for extraordinary expenses in dealing with witnesses that need protection because of their involvement in a case. Finally, the ODA, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, is truly one of the smallest prosecutor associations in the state. And one of our long-term goals is working with the legislature, hopefully, to look at ways to increase funding so we can enhance the services that we provide to criminal justice system here in Oregon. So at this point, I would be happy to answer any questions, or I can turn it over to Ms. Perlow.
Representative Stark. Thank you, Chair Barker. I'm looking at your graphs, and they're from 2010. I'm wondering if you can get us more recent information than those graphs, because a lot's happened.
It has. And Chair Barker, Representative Stark, that was the most recent information we could get at the national level. We will continue to try to update that, but believe it or not, that was the most recent information we could get for a national breakdown of that, but we will continue to try and get that.
Okay. Thank you.
My name is Patty Perlow, and I have the privilege of being the Lane County District Attorney. I have 27 years worth of material that I'm going to ratchet down to 10 minutes. I've only been the DA in Lane County for about 19 months now, and it has been a wonderful experience for me. We've gone from being one of the largest prison users in the state to ratcheting down to being, we're one of those, what are we called? We're called a green county now because we're exceeding the expectations of the Criminal Justice Commission with our programs. I'll get into that in a moment. My office has a budget of just over $10 million, and a third of that is grant funded. The Lane County is a poor county, and so our general fund contribution from Lane County is just over $7 million. I have about 70 FTE. Of that, 29 of them are prosecutors. Four of them are assigned to child support enforcement and collected $22 million for Lane County children last year. Just four lawyers did that. In the criminal division, we have 22 lawyers who prosecute criminal cases. We're divided into four teams. We have a major crimes team that has five lawyers. They handle the bulk of their caseload is child sex abuse cases. I mean, that it makes up the majority of what five lawyers handle. They are supposed to be handling all of the homicides, stabbings, robberies, and all of that that happens in Lane County because we have had a huge rash of homicides over the last couple of years. Those cases are now being farmed out to general prosecuting attorneys in the office because our major crimes team can't handle the volume. We have a domestic violence team that includes a grant-funded investigator, and he does incredible follow-up work to make sure that those very difficult cases are handled appropriately and effectively. Our grants require that we do not fail to file any provable domestic violence case, and so they work hard to make sure the cases are provable before they take the before they charge them. We have two general teams. Our misdemeanor lawyers, our newest lawyers, are supervised by the two senior lawyers that are supervisors to make sure that they get effective mentoring. Lane County has a very new office. Since I took over, we've had a lot of retirements, and so almost half of the lawyers, of those 22 lawyers, have about 5 years or less experience, which was a great boon for the county budget. We have one lawyer assigned to, so if you're taking into the account of what the DAs are making, comparing them to the public defenders, you might want to take Lane County out of that calculation. We have one lawyer assigned to juvenile. I also have two full-time medical examiner investigators. We have a third one that's been approved by the county because it's impossible to provide 24-hour, 7-day response to unattended, unexplained deaths with two people. And so the state provides us a doctor. My office pays for the lease of the morgue, all of the supplies, the investigators, their cars, their equipment, and everything related to that. But I'm not going to grumble because we're grateful to have a doctor in Lane County. We have, as I mentioned, a third of our budget is grant funded, and out of that we have a number of terrific programs in Lane County. We get JRI money and from the Criminal Justice Commission that has funded two lawyers for a prison diversion program, and that is how we have been able to divert medium to high-risk offenders from state corrections. They get intensive supervision, housing, mentorship, education. We have a relationship with Lane Community College. We have employment. Paul Solomon from Sponsors says if he can get a sex offender a job, he can get anybody a job. And we have something really unique. We have access to a woman in Springfield who does testing to help determine how a person learns. And so people in our jail staff have taken the test, as well as people who are on supervision, to determine. You tell somebody you have to get a full-time job or go to school full-time or you're in violation of your probation. And some people aren't ready. They need to go back and learn how to read before you can put them in that position. And so I have the privilege of coming into Lane County at a time when the stars are aligned and the people are right, and we really are making some huge advances in helping people get out of the criminal justice system. You might note from the Criminal Justice Commission statistics that Lane County has one of the best recidivism rates. And a lot of that is owed to the collaboration between our reentry program, our parole and probation, our Health and Human Services Division. I could go on and on, I'm sorry. It's very exciting to me to be the DA in Lane County and talk about all the things we have going on. We have a robust series of treatment courts. Our drug court, we don't call it that now, we call it treatment court, but so that you know what I'm talking about, I will refer to it as drug court, has a capacity for about 125 people at a time. And we just graduated 9 people. I attend all of the graduations because it is my favorite thing to watch people come from a program with employment, getting their kids back who've been in dependency, having housing. We have a veterans court that has capacity for about 25 veterans. We have just started in October, and it took me over a year to get this into place, a mental health court that we were denied a grant that we applied for, but all of the parties, all the players in Lane County agreed it was important enough that we would do it with our existing resources. And that's created a lot of challenges, and we are applying for a grant again, but we have capacity for 10 people in our mental health court. And that is not adequate for the need. While we're talking about that, on any given day in the Lane County Jail, about 60% of the people in there identify as having some sort of mental, are impacted by some form of mental illness or mental instability. So our jail capacity is 327 minus the federal order. And so 60% of that population at any given time is a big number, and to have capacity for 10 in our mental health court is inadequate. But we're working on it. We had a grant from JRI for a community prosecution program. It was a diversion program for low-level, low-risk felons, people who are just getting into the criminal justice system with a felony on a property crime, and they would be referred to the Center for Dialogue and Resolution, and the victim and the defendant would have an opportunity to actually meet and talk about what the impact to the victim of the crime was. And if the victim doesn't want to participate, they get somebody in a similar circumstance to come in and talk with the defendant. That grant funding ran out in August of 2015. It was a program that was just getting off the ground, so our LIPSC, our Public Safety Coordinating Council, helped allocate some funds to keep that program going for another year. But with reductions in JRI funding, we are running out of the ability to continue to fund that program. My office is continuing to do it for free, but the Center for Dialogue and Resolution had to hire staff, and they can't continue to do it for free. So those are some of the highlights of Lane County, and I would be happy to entertain any questions. Oh, I will mention that we don't do dependency work in Lane County, and that is a long story that I would love to come back and talk to you, because I have not taken my fingers out of trying to make the system a better place for Lane County kids, even if my office isn't going into the courtroom.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, but just a comment. Tim, I'm a little frustrated with you that you haven't brought her up here before. We've been paying attention to what you've been doing down in Lane County, and just really want to say thank you for what you've been doing. So,
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, it has just been my privilege to get to do that, and I wish I wish you all could come down and see what we've got going on there. It's incredible.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Congratulations on what you described as a low recidivism rate. That's a big deal. Two statements you made that really aren't congruent, so I want to give you an opportunity to explain those to me, because they're kind of stuck in my head. One is that you said you're one of the lowest users or in the green zone of using the prison system. And then you were talking about you have had a, quote, rash of homicides over the last couple years. So I don't know if that's a time issue or what, but those two statements don't quite go together. So I'd love some more thought on that.
So the green zone on prison use was related to we met our target on property and drug offenders and the reduction of prison use.
That helps.
We have not had a successful reduction in violent crime in Lane County, despite, you know, everybody's best efforts. For a little history, Lane County did not have any jail capacity, and my office lost a third of its staff in 2012. And we weren't filing a lot of low-level felony charges. We weren't filing any misdemeanor charges other than DUI. And we weren't filing drug charges. And people were amassing significant enough criminal histories to go straight to prison without any intervention. So we've made great strides in that.
Thanks for that clarification. That helps a lot.
Thank you. Representative Greenick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask a sort of philosophical question that perhaps either you can answer. You pointed out that in your charge for being a DA, there's the pursuit of justice. But the criminal system is an adversarial system, and the prosecutors are on one side of the adversary side and the defense is on the other side frequently. How do you balance your sort of responsibility for being an advocate to put the bad guys away at the same time you're dealing with the seeking of justice in the broader context?
Can you take that? Representative Greenlee, my job is more of a policy position now rather than the adversarial go into the courtroom position. And so I don't know if any of you knew Greg Hazarbedian. He was the Lane County public defender who just retired and a wonderful person to work with to make advances in our community in how to address the needs of people. I mean, you can be adversarial in the courtroom in trying to prove a case and send somebody to the Department of Corrections. But for the most part, those people are coming back to your community, and you want to have them set up for the best possible outcome when they do. And so I don't get to go into the courtroom anymore. My office is too big. My community's too big for me to get in and scrap anymore. But I think that what I'm doing now is actually more important and better for our community than what I used to do.
I may follow up just a bit. You point out that most of the adjudications in the criminal justice system relate to plea bargaining. We sometimes talk about sentencing issues with the representatives of the DAs here, and they'll argue that we need to have really stronger sentencing requirements than we'll actually use because we want to use them to essentially blackmail the felons into taking a lesser charge. I'm phrasing that a little strongly, but it sometimes sounds like that. The actual balance, it seems to me, of justice and your good responsibility, getting the bad guys put away, happens at the bargaining level or at the pretrial level. How do you train your deputies to be concerned with the broader issue of justice while they're fulfilling their responsibility to put the bad folks away?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, we had almost 7,000 criminal cases come into my office last year, and something between 5,500 and 5,700 cases were actually filed.
That's terrible.
And of that, two-thirds of those were felonies and one-third were misdemeanors because we have 7 municipal courts in my county. And of those, 1,017 felony cases went to grand jury and were indicted. And of those, well, most over 90% of all of the cases resolved by plea negotiation. But I take and I instill in my lawyers a very strong ethical responsibility that you don't use charging instruments as leverage. You don't overcharge a case with the hope of resolution because that would be a violation of your ethical obligations. But what we do is file an information that reflects some portion of the charges that would be available if the case were to proceed further. And when you have a good relationship with the defense attorneys in your community and they recognize that you are filing a preliminary charging document that only has a few of the available charges so that the defendant can take early recognition and accountability for what they've done and then try to address what should happen as a result of those few criminal charges that were filed. That system actually works really well.
Thank you. Representative Langer.
Thank you for being here. And I think it's clear from both of your presentations and the work I've seen your association do that you're a really justice-seeking, justice-oriented body of public servants. And so my question has to do with, in that frame, recognizing that you're part of the criminal justice system, advocacy is very justice-seeking, and the public defense side is also justice-seeking. Do you see a role for teamwork in trying to address the radical disparity in resource available to the two sides of that, dialectic? Because if one side of the team of the conversation that is representing really low-income people is kind of getting crushed under 400 misdemeanor caseloads. And I know, do you feel like there's a need for both parts of that conversation to come together to seek resources that enable both the defense side and the prosecution side to be adequately resourced?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger, I think as Cosine can tell you that when we were about to ramp up the number of cases we were filing, I was an advocate for more resource going into the Lane County Public Defender's Office because I knew that they weren't going to be able to handle the volume of what we were planning ahead. And we did work together in that sense to make sure that there were at least more adequate resources. I recognize that. I mean, I only have 22 lawyers reviewing 7,000 cases. They have, 12 to 15 in the Lane County Public Defender's Office, and then we have a consortium of lawyers that handles the overflow. It actually is pretty evenly balanced on the number of lawyers handling the cases, but I do recognize the need for a resource assessment.
Olson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, Tim, you were back. You were involved with us deeply when we were crafting House Bill 3194 for the Justice Reinvestment Initiative and where we were going with community corrections. That would not have happened, without your support, and especially the District Attorneys Association, and seeking, honestly, I see three different components to that. Seeking justice, considering mercy, but I think that's where you're at anyways with each DA, as well as walking through it with humility. I'm curious your thoughts on that. Because with that, you can't have a cookie-cutter approach to each. You just can't.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, thank you for the question. I mean, I think all district attorneys and people who do criminal defense work know that the system cannot work without talented individuals on both sides and people that are willing to work together. I can remember coming in many times to testify when the Public Defense Services budget is up, to come in and to talk about the need for well-compensated attorneys at that level. And Ms. Cosine has come in and testified on behalf of the district attorney's budget. So we all, I think, are very aware that we need to work together. And I think we have.
Okay, thanks.
Actually, Ms. Callahan just made the point I was going to make, which is the DAs show up in every budget cycle and testify for pay parity. And I want to thank you for that because it sends a very strong message that we do need to shore up that disparity between the two sides in these cases. And I also just want to thank DA Perlow for what you've done in Lane County, because you guys are the shining example of what we're trying to do with justice reinvestment. And when we have treatment courts and when we deal with reentry and we figure out housing and we do all of these things for supports around vulnerable folks and families, that we can get better results for both the criminal justice system and for the community. And so I just really want to thank you. The last 19 months, you really changed the trajectory of Lane County.
Thank you.
And I'll just kind of address Representative Greenlick's remarks also about the overpower, the power of the district attorney. I've heard that complaint from people who are usually trying to eliminate Measure 11, which was voted in twice by the people. And I don't see, I mean, as a cop, I used to be frustrated because I think I have this great felony case and it would be pled down. And we could not go to trial in all cases in Oregon. The courts couldn't do it. You just simply could not do it. And I've, at least, in Multnomah County, I've seen great care taken in how they handle it. When they have a meeting on a Measure 11 crime to decide whether to charge it Measure 11 or not, and many times they do not. And I think that the elected district attorney's offices are every bit as responsible as judges. And I've said before, I got my daughter in trouble with the judge because she was streaming my remarks. And just because you put the word judge in front of somebody's name doesn't necessarily impart great wisdom to that person. And we're all human. But I think that the district attorneys do a good job, and I don't see them. I mean, this theory that I stop somebody driving down the street and I charge them with robbery one, that they haven't done anything wrong, and then you come and say, well, we'll give you 3 years if you'll plead to second degree, doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. Those people are facing those crimes. And yes, sometimes that's a big one if I get convicted. But it's not like they haven't done something or they wouldn't be charged. And if they haven't done something, they wouldn't take the deal. That's in my opinion. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Overview of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, please. Juliet Britton and Sid Moore.
Good afternoon, Chairman Barker, members of the committee. I'm Juliet Britton. I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Psychiatric Security Review Board, and this is...
Hello, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Sid Moore. I'm the Deputy Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board.
So we're going to spend about 20 minutes giving a big overview of what our agency does. It's a very unique program in the United States and something we're very proud of. So just big picture on what the board actually does. We supervise those who are charged with a felony crime, who are adjudicated, who successfully assert the insanity defense, and are placed under our jurisdiction. So we do the supervision and monitoring once the case is completely done for a certain amount of time that the judge has placed them under jurisdiction. So in our state, we call that GEI, guilty except for insanity. And if you're a youth, it's called responsible except for insanity. And more recently, since 2013, we've also begun to supervise non-criminal defendants. There's a new type of civil commitment that was created, and for a very narrow population in the community. And so now we have a certain type of civil commitment that we also supervise. As a result of some new legislation, we also have a sex offender classification and release program. It mirrors the same program that Board of Parole is doing. It requires that all of our sex offenders have some sort of risk classification based on a 3-2-1 system. And by 2019, we will have to have a relief program or reclassification program stood up where these individuals can come and request reclassification of their risk or relief from registration. Prior to that bill being passed, the courts would do that. And so as far as the individuals that are adjudicated GEI sex offenders, that responsibility was given to us. And then finally, we continue to be the mental health firearm prohibitor relief authority. So for those individuals that have a civil commitment, who want to request their firearm privileges get restored, we're the relief authority for that. What we don't do, for those that sit on the Ways and Means, you might have heard that the 370 or aid and assist population at the state hospital has increased over 100% over the last few years. My agency has nothing to do with the 370s. Those are individuals that are still pre-trial, and therefore we do not supervise or monitor the aid and assist population. We also don't provide direct services to these individuals that supervise. We rely upon the county mental health agencies, the state hospital, and the mental health system to take that role. And then finally, we do not fund the treatment or supervision of individuals living in the community. The vast majority of individuals under our jurisdiction are Medicaid eligible, so the vast majority of their services are paid with a federal matching fund. While they're at the state hospital, though, that's a general fund, 100% general fund, as you probably are aware. So the history of the PSRB goes back to about 40 years. We were the first state to create this model to supervise those that are successfully asserting the insanity defense. The program really started with the judges coming to the legislature and saying, we don't have the mental health expertise or the manpower to supervise individuals that we're adjudicating. And so this is where this multidisciplinary board idea came about. Since then, several other states have mirrored our program, and it really is considered the gold star. In fact, we received a gold star award from the American Psychiatric Association. I think these additional duties that we've received over the last few years were viewed as sort of the mental health risk experts, and we have the resources and infrastructure in the community to safely manage individuals with mental illness. I think that's why we're getting those additional responsibilities. Our mission is public safety, and that does not mean locking individuals up in a state hospital for their entire length of jurisdiction. Slow community reintegration has been proven to maximize an individual's recovery and actually shows some long-term lower risk for recidivism. So when you take a look at our numbers of where our clients are living, I think, and our recidivism, I think that'll support that. So this is the profile of our panel. Similar to our previous speakers, I cannot overestimate how hard our board members work. They all have full-time jobs. They give up a day of their income to make $358 to sit on a panel. We have hearings three or four times a month, and they also meet administratively. It's multidisciplinary. That is considered best practices when we're talking about risk assessment and making decisions. And the bread and butter of what our board does really is the hearings process. We have a contested case administrative hearings process. Last year, we did over 600 hearings. So this shows the visual of where our clients fall in the criminal justice system. It's at the very end. So once the court adjudicates someone GEI, that is where the court involvement ends. From then on, the PSRB forever will be responsible for their supervision and monitoring. So aside from conducting our hearings, we also spend a significant amount of staff and board time actually working with our community partners who are supervising most of our clients who are in the community. I have two FTE. That's all they do. They're dedicated to working with who we call case managers. That's kind of the probation officer, if you will, for our clients living in the community. We're constantly working with our mental health practitioners and working collaboratively, identifying ways we can find housing for some of our hard-to-place clients and also employment opportunities and whatnot. We regularly are doing training, particularly with the legal community. We want to make sure that appropriately placed defendants are coming under the PSRB. And I've frequently are training district attorneys, defense counsel, and judges throughout the state. Because really, we get the cases that are given to us. We have no choice in which cases we get. So community education with the legal community is a big part of what we do. At every hearing, the board has to make a finding that the individual continues to have a mental illness or mental developmental disability, and that when that illness is active, they are a substantial danger to others. If the answer is no to either one of those, we're required to release them from supervision. And in our world, we call that discharge from supervision. The most typical diagnosis of individuals who are placed under our supervision are the thought disorders, schizophrenia, as well as mood disorders. We have a small portion of our adult, about 5% of our adults also have a developmental disability. And we really use the DSM-5 to kind of guide, what causes someone to be under our jurisdiction. We have some statutory guidance as well as some case law that tells the trial attorneys and judges and the board what is not a mental illness, and these are the three categories: personality disorder, drug and alcohol psychosis, and sexual conduct disorder. So our population right now is 581. It has been upwards of 800 about 10 years ago, and it really has declined since this body passed that certified evaluator requirement. For those that might recall, in 2012 and 13, anytime a guilty except for insanity plea is submitted to a judge, there's now a requirement that a certified evaluator provide a written report. And that, again, was an effort to make sure that we're getting appropriately placed individuals under our jurisdiction. So the most frequent question I get from legislators is, how do you make the decision to place somebody in the community? So there's two ways this can happen. The first is when the person is adjudicated at court, the judge can actually place them directly into the community. That's called court conditional release. We average about 40 new clients a year, and only about 5 to 10 a year are entering the community straight from court. So the vast majority of our clients are going to the state hospital for from treatment before the PSRB ends up conditionally releasing them. There's a 5-layer review process. If any of these individuals say no at any point in the conditional release planning time frame, it basically stops, and no one is going to be forced into the community unless the community provider and the county mental health and the hospital and the board all agree that the person is ready for conditional release and the plan that's being proposed is appropriate.
Yes,
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of the folks that are released to the community, so all of those various folks are involved, but are these the ones that can end up in a house, a kind of a care facility that may have a small number of folks that's located in the community? Is that what we're talking about with community care?
Chairman Barker, Representative Gorsuch, yes. And I have a slide that gives the breakdown of what level of care clients live at. And right, virtually all of the clients coming from the hospital are going to that level of care. And I can describe what services are offered at that level of care.
Well, can I do one quick follow-up? One thing that I've heard from some folks in law enforcement and also some community members is that they don't get notified that those folks are in the community. Is that true or not?
Chairman Barker, Representative Gorsuch, law enforcement absolutely gets notified of PSRB.
Okay.
Now, we do need to make clear, though, that some of these homes have a mixed population of PSRB and non-PSRB. right? People might be there voluntarily. They might have just completed their Department of Corrections sentence. So I suspect that's maybe where that report's coming from. Okay. But as a professional courtesy, it's not required by statute. We do that.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
So this is the graphic depiction of where our client's living. The blue line is the state hospital, or Junction City would be included in that, and the red line is the population on conditional release. It directly relates to the legislature allocating resources to develop programs in the community where we can put individuals. And as you can see, when you build it, they come, and our numbers are now much higher in the community. We currently have the lowest GEI census in the state hospital in many, many years. So from a fiscal standpoint, this is saving general fund dollars because, again, if you're living in the community, first of all, clients can have their own income, right? They can work and whatnot, pay for their cost of care, and there's some federal Medicaid matching funds that is also available. So this is the slide, Representative Gorsuch, that I was talking about. We have various levels of care where our clients live. The vast majority are going to come out of the state hospital and live at an RTF or H level. That is a unlocked facility, 24/7 awake staff. The secure facility is very similar, except it's locked doors and it has nursing staff. So a secure facility does not mean you're going to be locked up,
right?
You're going to go out for outings, but you might have diabetes where you need nursing care. You might be very symptomatic in terms of anxiety and need lots of staff support. So the secure facilities provide that for those individuals. Doesn't mean you're dangerous necessarily. It just means you need more support. And as our clients meet their treatment goals and show that they can maintain or exercise their privileges appropriately, many of them move on to live in supported housing or even independent living. Day in the life of the PSRB is going to include structured activity provided by these same mental health programs that are supervising and monitoring and providing residential services. Many of our, particularly our younger transitional age youth clients are attending school, the same partnerships that Lane County's district attorney was talking about. You know, we have clients going to University of Oregon, Portland Community College, as well as some of our employment specialists are working with employers to employ our clients. That's viewed as the number one intervention for transitional age youth is employment. So how well are these community providers doing? They're doing fantastic. I'd like to say this is the board's responsibility, but I really need to give credit to the county mental health agencies that are working with our clients. We have a less than 1% recidivism rate. We definitely supervise our individuals much closer than somebody coming out of prison. And our hope is to continue this moving forward for sure. We're going to continue on with our safety mandate, and I will note that our recidivism actually has gone down even though our conditional release numbers have gone up. So it really speaks to this model for this specific population in terms of its effectiveness. So we're also looking at using our community resources, those SRTF beds, to minimize rehospitalization. So for example, if someone's living independently and might have some increased symptoms and needs a little more support, we're much more likely now to revoke them automatically because they've had a change in mental health, and much more likely to maybe step them up to a higher level of care. We certainly have revocation as a last resort, and that's how we view rehospitalization.
Sorry, I have another question for you then. Is that then similar to when we revoke somebody's parole or probation? Is there a hearing that goes on for that, and who does that if there is?
Chairman Barker, Representative Gorsuch, yes. It's viewed as similar to that. They get sent back to the state hospital, and we have a hearing within 20 days.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Greenlake has a question. Hi.
Hi.
When you talked about the 1% recidivism rate, were you using that the same as revoking, or was recidivism a recommit?
Chairman Barker, Representative Greenleck, when we say recidivism, we mean commit a new crime while on supervision. And unlike corrections, who only, I think their recidivism, the new definition goes for 3 years, that was a cumulative rate.
What's the revocation rate?
It's, well, the inverse of that, Representative Greenleck, is we maintain 99% of our clients every month. So it would be 1%. We average about 20 revocations a year.
Mm. Thank you.
Representative,
thank you, Chair Barker. I appreciate the recidivism rates there on the misdemeanors and felonies. How has the community response been? What as far as when they're there, are you getting complaints from the community? Are there nuisance issues? Are there police being called out for activities but not necessarily filing charges? Just the overall community response that doesn't end up in a criminal charge.
Chairman Barker, Representative Stark. Certainly, when a new program is developed, there's often NIMBY issues, not in my backyard. But virtually in all the cases, I've been with the board for 7 years, and we've opened at least 4 or 5 programs. That always dies down. And in fact, we have our providers, getting those same neighbors who first complained. They're bringing cookies over to our clients, and really there's quite a bit of outreach and improvement in those kind of initial not in my backyard issues. They're, in general, out of all of the various populations, if you compare like the civil population or those on probation, our clients tend to be the more psychiatrically stable. I mean, they've made it through the aid and assist process, right? So all of our clients were well enough to meet competency requirements. They respond well to medications. So at baseline, our clients tend to be more stable. And so the nuisance complaints tend to come from maybe the non-PSRB residents, for example. That's been my experience. We really don't have a lot of police contact. We have a lot of I shouldn't say a lot. We have a few because we have a LEDS terminal. We'll get a hit that, the police ran somebody for looking suspicious, but not an arrest. Okay. So we're going to continue to work with our partners. We continue to have some difficulty in placing certain types of patients, particularly as our population ages. There is going to be a great need, I'm sure you all are aware, of facilities who can specialize not only in the dementia, cognitive decline of our aging population, but on top of that, a major mental illness. You can't just place one of our clients in a traditional enhanced care facility. So that is a need that we're working with our partnering agencies. So individuals are not in hospice at the state hospital. We're trying to get those individuals in a community setting. We're also very proud of the fact that we're integrating trauma-informed practices into our business. That might mean how we look and conduct hearings, the layout of the room, what services we offer to victims or clients who might have high anxiety at a hearing. So we're quite proud about that. And kind of the typical challenges that we always say when we come before you. There's uncertain funding in the future. The reality is that just like the Indigent Defense Service, our clients are virtually Medicaid, almost all virtually Medicaid eligible. So we're dealing with a population that quite poverty-stricken and in need of public assistance. We also continue to have rental barriers, housing issues. So not only is there a shortage of housing, when there's a choice of renters, it's our clients that tend to not get selected. So we're continuing to work at working through those barriers. So we have a couple proposed legislation, and I think hopefully they'll come to this committee. But we were talking about restorative justice earlier in the presentation before us. We would like to create a restorative justice program and really kind of clean up some of the statutory wording of our bills and making our agency more efficient. I won't go into too much detail because I want to save some time for your questions. So with that,
I have a question that if it's going to take a long time, I'll talk to you offline. But I just got inundated with emails a couple weeks ago. Rios, you know, okay. So, and it from just what I gleaned out of those that so somebody was sent to the hospital, but either whatever that charge was has been changed, and so it was no longer a charge, and he's been let out, and he's still dangerous. And he's actually living in my neighborhood. Or at least he was going to. I don't know where he is, but
Chairman Barker, so as I said in our earlier slide, at every hearing we have to make a finding that somebody has a qualifying mental illness, and if not, we have to discharge them from supervision. So, you know, periodically we do get requests from the state hospital where it's their clinical opinion that somebody does not have a mental illness. They're required actually under the statute to request a hearing, and the board is required under current law to discharge them from supervision. And so as I talked about the certified evaluator program, since 2012, one of the main goals for that program is to hopefully decrease the chance that somebody gets placed in our system inappropriately. The particular case that you mentioned, that individual was placed under our jurisdiction in the 80s, yeah, and spent 30 plus years in the state hospital. So we hope those kind of cases are few and far between, especially with that certified evaluator program.
So, but was he evaluated as being safe? I mean, the things I'm being told that they said, no, he's still dangerous, so we've got to let him go.
Chairman Barker, if you do not have a mental illness, the current statutory scheme requires the PSRB to release them from supervision, whether they're dangerous or not.
And was his mental status, did his mental status change, or did the law change that said that he's no longer crazy, if you will? That's what I didn't understand.
Representative Barker, it's a little bit complex. You know, I certainly could talk
after you if you want,
and we can kind of explain that. Okay. But in general, clinical diagnoses do change.
Yeah. Okay. So that changed about him, and not the law. Okay.
There was some law change though, both in the mid 2000s, and that's where sexual conduct disorder and alcohol and drugs are no longer. So that also contributes to some of these discharges.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? I have a last question. You certainly may.
Thank you, sir. Do you have any suggestions on how to deal with the 370 population? Because I'm really worried about that.
Representative Barker, I often get asked that question. I try to stay in my little PSRB lane. Some of the programs that you heard today, particularly from Lane County, I think you'll start to see the numbers go down. It's very clear that our and it's not just the district attorneys. It really is we're seeing counties more and more work collaboratively with defense counsel, district attorney, and mental health coming together and trying to divert cases that shouldn't go down a criminal justice response. And I think we're seeing that in Marion County. Klamath, I know, has had programs. And so I think as those programs expand and these specialty courts allow for some diversion, I think that's going to cause the numbers to go down.
For the members of the committee, 260 beds of the 650 beds of the state hospital are occupied right now by the aid and assist population, eating up our resources.
Yeah, huge resource.
There is, some states manage that issue by charging counties for misdemeanant hospitalizations.
There you go.
There's lots of different solutions across the nation, but I'll leave it for Oregon Health Authority to resolve that.
One of the solutions literally is not to arrest somebody, but I heard there is somebody in the state hospital waiting a trial on littering. He's been in the state hospital for 60 days. Not able to aid and assist in the littering charge. I mean, that just never should have happened.
Yeah. Not her fault. Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Committee, just a reminder, next Friday morning over at the Salem Convention Center, there's an informational meeting on
work. What Friday, right?
17th.
A week from tomorrow. Yeah.
And it's a morning session. It says 9 o'clock on the posting. I had 8 in my calendar, but 8 to
registration.
9 is good. Okay.
9 is way better.
Yeah. No further business before the committee. We stand adjourned. Thank you, committee. No further business before the committee. We stand adjourned. Thank you, committee.